So the question was asked, when do we know which opinions are within the realm of halakha, which are out of the realm of halakha? When do we call it a leniency, or when do we say that's a transgression? And you find different people saying different things. So in truth, we could just define the realm of halakha. And it gets a little bit complex and a little bit political. Because when you hear people quoting, well, I'm relying on so-and-so, and you're not sure, is that within the realm of halakha or out of the realm of halakha? So you're entering something which it has a true answer, but that doesn't mean you're going to be able to verify it so easily. Meaning, questions like this are going to be politicized. And you also enter a realm which is a little bit difficult to verify, because you never know who's the radical. Where are the guidelines that are true halakha, and where are the what's beyond the guidelines? Now, that's why this question is really very encompassing, because the question is really asking, what are the parameters of halakha? When do you start transgressing halakha? And basically, the question is also asking, which people really represent halakha and which do not? Because you could just Google a question today. A friend of mine told me he wants to start a website where you put in the question and put in the answer you want to hear, and then you just do a search, who says that? So we live in a day and age where the world is much smaller, in that you can hear what anyone has to say. You want to wake up in the morning and know who's happy, you just go on Facebook, hi, I'm happy today. You want to know who woke up this morning and thinks it's hard to breathe because of the cloud, you just open your Facebook, you can hear how everyone feels this morning. Any person who has any semblance of capacity to write anything can post his opinion and make it very public. And that doesn't mean that there's any validity to his opinion. We have an alumni from here who posted an article and quoted me, and posted an article in a certain direction that was not exactly in a correct direction, in my opinion, halachically. And now my name is quoted there, and his whole article is there. And a lot of people read what he wrote. I mean, you can see down there what he wrote. And he gives the impression that he knows what he's talking about, but then, thank God, some people started asking him, did you ever read the quote, the sources you're quoting? And he, at least he was honest enough to admit he didn't. And suddenly it became very clear that he didn't know very much, but he knew how to quote things that other people quoted from other works. Meaning, even me, he wasn't quoting me, he was quoting a quote that I quoted from a work. Now, being that he never learned the work, he didn't understand what I was quoting, and he misquoted it, or he misappropriated it. So, today this question becomes more relevant than it ever was, because today a lot of people give themselves title rabbi. I know that there's a site that links to mine where the guy calls himself rabbi, but if you just read what he writes, it's not in accordance with traditional Judaism, even though he considers himself an Orthodox rabbi. And there's more than one site that way. There's a site that's one of the biggest Torah sites in the world today. And if you read what he writes, I don't know if I should even say it publicly or not. I don't know. I have to think it through. I won't decide that now. You see that it's in direct discord with our halacha. And at one point we wanted to link our sites, his to mine, mine to his, because he has excellent content. You know, if you search the word Torah online, his is one of the first to show up. And then I realized what he wrote, and even though technically his site only provides a service where they give you the text for free, but I realized that it's not in line with Allah. So I called him up and I said, hey, what's going on here? So he said to me, that's Maimonides' opinion. So I said, really? Where does Maimonides say that? So he gave me a source. So I opened it up while we were on the phone and I said, I don't think that's what Maimonides is saying. So he said to me, that's my interpretation of Maimonides. So I said, wait a second, but your interpretation contradicts what Maimonides wrote here and what Maimonides wrote there and what it says in the Talmud here and what it says in the Talmud there, and you're presenting an opinion that just doesn't fit not with Maimonides, nor with the Talmud, which is Maimonides' source. So he said to me, well, I interpret those sources differently. I said, Kesef Mishnah doesn't understand that way. Other commentaries don't understand that way. And quite honestly, the words don't read the way you choose to understand it. So he said to me, yeah, but that's my interpretation. And with that, the conversation ended. And I said, no, thank you. My side is not linked to his, nor is his linked to mine. Thank God. But he has a following. And he has a lot of power today because he is one of the big sites. You know, I just pray that he doesn't start publicizing his own opinions, so long as it's just texts. You know, okay. I wouldn't use his texts anyways. But
you wouldn't say the name.
I don't know if I should say the name, so I'd rather think it through. I don't want to. It's not a decision that should be made on the spur of the moment. So I'll think about it, and maybe in the future date I'll say the name. So today it becomes a challenge. It's a bigger challenge than ever. In the past, things were a little bit clearer. You had Orthodox, you had Conservative, you had Reform. You knew Orthodox goes one way. Conservative tries to make themselves look more like Orthodox, but they always weren't. Today it's abundantly clear that they aren't. And then Reform, you know, okay, there's Reform. Today the difference between Conservative and Reform is very hard to tell. Things have shifted. But within what people call Orthodox and modern Orthodox, you suddenly hit a problem where people call themselves Orthodox, but they're leading unorthodox lives, and they're doing things that are completely in contradiction with Orthodoxy. But they maintain the banner of Orthodoxy. And there's a guy online who calls himself Rabbi on Facebook, and he's completely not Orthodox in what he writes. I only know him because one of our students, that's his Rabbi. And this guy was learning here, and he kept quoting things from his Rabbi, and I couldn't figure out. I kept respecting his rabbi because our policy here in Machon Meir is that we always respect other rabbis, and even if they say things differently than we see them, if that's your rabbi, we'll respect them, fine. And only after he left the Machon, and then he friended me on Facebook, and then I saw who this wacko is, and I'm sorry, the guy, I wouldn't have him over to my house. I wouldn't want to have a conversation for 2 minutes with him. The guy's whacked. I mean, look at his profile. I hate kids. I don't think anyone should ever get married. You know, all kinds of whacked out things. You start reading it. You say, okay, this guy's got problems. It's very sad that he puts the title rabbi before his name, and other people have decided he should be their rabbi, but he doesn't deserve any such title. So today it's a challenge. Let's go one step at a time. So being that it's a challenge, I think that what a person has to do is define for himself a certain path. Meaning, a person can say, you know, I don't want to do the most stringent things in life. Fine, no one's asking you to do the most stringent things in life. But if a person has chosen to adopt an Orthodox lifestyle, then he should find within accepted Orthodoxy who are the people he could turn to. And I suggest that he tell those people, I want to be lenient. There's a person who transcribes a lot of Rav Eliashiv's Piskei Halachot, a lot of what Rav Eliashiv passions. And he told me that he always tells Rav Eliashiv, don't treat me as a Talmud Chacham. Please treat me like an Amal Aretz, like the simplest Jew on the street. I want to know how lenient I can be. I want to know what the limit of leniencies are. The limit of leniencies in halacha. He's writing down halacha, and he wants to know that he's getting the parameters. He doesn't want stringencies in halacha. He wants to know, what can I do? Not what can I do to be extra pious, but what can I do and be a kosher Jew? There is a range. There's definitely a range where a person can choose to be more pious or less pious. We'll get to you in a minute. And a person can be more lenient and more stringent. Let's take, for example, the Rambam says one may kiss his sister, but it's not an intelligent thing to be touchy with one's sister. So it's not prohibited. We assume that a person isn't thinking improper things. If he is, then it is prohibited. But assuming what?
And it's also whacked.
Okay, assuming that he's normal, what?
Referring to afterwards or before?
Either way. assuming that a person is it doesn't affect them in any way, so then it's considered something which is permissible, but not the way that an intelligent person should probably act. If a person is within a culture, or that everyone in his family is accustomed to that when you meet, you kiss, and if he's not going to give his sister a kiss on the cheek, then everyone's going to think he's whacked out. Okay, it's permissible. There's no reason he shouldn't do it, assuming that it doesn't affect him. So that's an example of something. And we have many things that way. Take the laws of male modesty. So a person that wants to be extra modest is going to always keep himself fully covered. Technically, if a person wants to walk around in shorts and a t-shirt, it's permissible. No one can say it's prohibited. You could discuss whether that's the way a person should show up to davening. Is that the respectful way to stand before God or not? Okay, it's a good question. It might depend on what, if you're living in a kibbutz where that's the way everyone is all the time, if you're living in Israel 25 years ago where you showed up to the Knesset that way in sandals, or you're living in Israel today where no one shows up to the Knesset that way anymore, and maybe today Israel has evolved also, or you're in the United States where no one shows up to anything respectable in shorts and a t-shirt, so then maybe that's not the way we should show up to davening. But again, it's not prohibited, it's a question of respect. So in halacha we have a range, and not only do we have a range, the tradition that I have is that before you answer a halachic question, you have to answer the question of who is standing before me. That there, halacha is always at least a two-stage process. The tradition I have from Rav Pesin Zatzal, who has this tradition from Rav Gustman Zatzal, was that before you paskin the shaila, you have to paskin the person. And that's why there are many questions that Rav Pesin Zatzal used to receive that he wouldn't answer. He'd tell the person, I don't know you. If I don't know you, I can't answer you. But isn't halacha black on white? No, halacha is not black on white. Halacha is very much about understanding the individual. I was interviewed for a position of a rabbi of a community a year ago, and I understood at the time that they were also interviewing people from their own community. So I said to them in the interview, I said, you have to know that my recommendation is that you have a big advantage if you take someone from your own community. Because if I'll be rabbi of this community, it's going to take me at least a year before I could answer many questions. Because many questions that you might have pertain specifically to who you are. And I don't know you yet. So I'm at a disadvantage. After a year, I'll start knowing you, so I'll be able to answer more questions. But so long as I don't know you, I can't answer. Because you have to know how lenient to be, how stringent to be, what answer fits this person. Halacha does give us a range. But there's an end point to that range. And at that point, it becomes prohibited. And the fact that today, or for the last, I guess since the advent of halacha really, you were always able to find people who were out of the range and claimed they were in the range. Korach was also out of the range and claimed he was in the range.
So then how did he turn the range?
So that you need tradition for. You need a rabbi who has tradition. It's not something that you can define just because today you open up a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. If you open a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, you're going to lead a life that is more stringent than it has to be. If you take your questions to a rabbi, then, assuming he understands you and your life, he will be able to give you the range of what's permissible. There is another point which we can't expand on, but part of what a rabbi is supposed to help a person with is growth. And when a person is in the process of tshuva or giyu, so then part of growth is that we don't only look at the range of what's permissible, we also think with the person how he grows into observing all of that. Meaning a person who's coming from life where he didn't keep Shabbos at all, if he walks in here and we tell him now, no turning on lights, no turning on cell phones, no doing, you give him a whole list of what he can't do over Shabbos, he might not last. Chances are he won't last. 99.999% of the people couldn't handle that. So someone who has experience, and that's why my recommendation to you guys is always find a rabbi who has experience with people in the gear or tshuva process, will work with you in your growth. So then a person will understand this is beyond the range. It's not that it's permissible, but being that I'm in the process of growing, I have to work to get within that range. I'm just not yet there. And that there's a big difference between saying this is permitted to saying this is not permitted, but in life, being that you're coming from a certain place, you'll grow and eventually you'll get there. And that's something which is not, we don't publicize. One of the reasons you'll see in the beginning of my website, there's a letter to the listener. And one of the things I write there in that letter is that all the halacha that we learn here in Machon Meir can be applied by the Machon Meir students and alumni and no one else. Because the halachas and the way I present them is taking into account where you guys are coming from. and I will very often present you with leniencies that I would never say to anyone else. There are leniencies that I feel will make your lives easier, and as you grow, you will discover that maybe these are leniencies and you should advance and not rely on these leniencies, but for now, being that they're within halachic range, so then I think they're fitting for you. But they're not. There's no reason why someone who comes from an Orthodox background and has led a life of being an observant Jew his whole life should suddenly say, oh, gee, I didn't know that. I could be lenient on this. Yeah, let me do that. No, that's not for him. So we, because when we decide about applying leniencies, we have to understand that we don't... Okay, there are different types of leniencies. We'll get to that, if you want, in a minute. There are different types of leniencies. Not all leniencies are created equal. Meaning it depends on why that's a leniency. Sometimes something is a leniency because it has certain opinions that give it halachic validity, and other opinions don't agree with it. So the opinions that give it validity are powerful enough that we can rely on them, but we wouldn't ideally rely on them. So a person in a situation where he's in a process of growth, we tell him, okay, you can rely on that. If a person is in a point where there's no reason for him to rely on it, that's fine. Sometimes a leniency stems from strength in halacha, meaning a person that knows halacha and is very powerful and has an excellent tradition, that person might be able to be lenient and tell you, the halacha is exactly this, and therefore this is permissible and that's prohibited, and he could get it down to the point where other people who are not as proficient in halacha as he is, they have to give a more general answer, which is going to be more stringent. In that case, the leniency is fit for everyone, because the leniency stems from strength. Sometimes the leniency is not stemming from strength, but rather stemming from the fact that there are multiple opinions, and someone who understands and has a tradition and knows how to apply halacha will know when and how we can apply leniency. An example of that I could give you in a minute, but first it sounds like there are more questions. So you, one second. You wanted something?
I just going back to the example you gave about someone who grew up Orthodox his entire life, and then here's a leniency. So let's say he says, you know, I'm Orthodox, I never knew there was a leniency, but I've always hated this. And it's always made me miserable. And if this is within halachic range, it is permissible, even though it's lenient, but I would live a happier life. Like, is that not something to say, you know, for you, even though you came, like, technically it's a step down, like, why would you say, no, definitely don't do that?
So again, and that's the challenge in addressing this question. You're taking the whole concept of halacha and you're trying to get it into a soundbite. Into like a short answer. It's not, you can't really do that. At the end of the day, the decision of when to be lenient and when not to be lenient is much of what's learned in rabbinic school. I mean, it's a learning that takes years. No, you have to know a whole lot about where the halacha is coming from in order to know when to apply a leniency. Meaning, there's a lot of calculations that go into deciding when you should be lenient and when you should be stringent. I could tell you that there are questions that come my way that I've sat in by my teachers maybe a decade already, hearing them ruling on these questions, and I still won't rule on them. Even though I know what my teachers will say, I will take it to my teachers because I don't feel that my proficiency in this area of halacha is strong enough to take that leniency on my shoulders. I've heard it for 10 years already, but administering a leniency to myself or to someone else is giving halachic ruling. And that halachic ruling has to stem from halachic basis. Halachic basis means I am proficient in that halacha. I understand where it's coming from. I understand the basis in that halacha. And therefore I can tell you that in this case you can be lenient. Well, there are areas that I know that my teachers are lenient in them, but I can't be lenient, and that's why more than once I've taken students from here to my teachers to ask their questions. Sometimes I really don't know the answer, but if it were only about that, then I could represent your question to someone else. Sometimes it's because I'm not fit to give an answer that you need to hear. You need someone with broader shoulders. So applying halacha requires a knowledge of halacha. Just because I heard that some rabbi gave some kind of leniency doesn't mean I'm allowed to rely on it. That's another point which I wanted to get to, that you're not allowed to derive halacha from what a rabbi paskin for someone else. Halacha is that you read a book, you read a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, so you know what the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch holds, and you could apply that to your life. But if you want to learn from a ruling of a rabbi to someone else, all that means is that that was the ruling for that person. It does not mean that that's a halachically acceptable leniency for anyone else. Right. You can't know what the rabbi took into account.
This makes it a very confusing lifetime, because here, let's say I'm not planning on going through rabbinic school. I'm not planning on becoming that knowledgeable. Because I don't have the time, and it's not my focus, whatever. Right, so now, I have... How do I understand that play? You said, if you take the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch by itself, so you're going to be forced to lead a much more stringent life than you need to. And you also said that if you tell someone who doesn't keep Shabbos to keep it 100%, they probably won't last. So if I have to start taking on every halacha in the most strict way possible, just because I don't know all the leniencies, then I probably won't last.
Right. So answer your own question now. Take it the next step. So what's the solution to that?
Ask rabbis.
Oh, I wouldn't say rabbis. I would say, like the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Asei lecha rav, make for yourself a rabbi. Now, I remember your stage of the game. I was there once. Not exactly, but similar. At your stage of the game, it seems very complicated, and it seems like every day you're going to be calling the rabbi with another question. But I'll tell you a secret. You're going to get married, and then hopefully your wife is going to be very serious and sincere about her observance of Torah and Mitzvot. And she's going to say, Yehuda, who told you we could do this? And you're going to say, okay, I'll ask the rabbi. And the first few times, because it's everything's lovey-dovey and it's in the beginning, you'll do it with a lot of patience. But after a few times, you'll suddenly realize that, hey, these questions keep coming up. The same question keeps coming up. And if you keep notes, if you just take notes on what you asked and what the answer you got, you'll see you won't even fill up one notebook. You'll see. You'll see that most of the questions are really the same question repeating itself that you've just never verified. There are very few new questions. I can tell you, I've been married for 8 years now. I've been asking, I haven't filled up one notebook. And believe me, I ask on every nuance that I'm not sure about. And I haven't yet filled up one notebook. No. And guys come here, you know. We had a notebook for questions and answers 1 year because guys kept forgetting their questions throughout the 2 weeks until we'd hit a Thursday night. So we kept the notebook where guys could write their questions, and then on Thursday night we'd deal with it. Once upon a time we were organized in this class. You'd be surprised. People always feel throughout the 2 weeks they have so many questions for Thursday night. There aren't so many questions. It feels like there are many because the same question is gnawing and it shows up again and again and again. You'll be surprised that you might... It might not sound believable what I'm telling you now, but try it for 2 months and see. I don't think you'll have that many questions after 2 months. I wish that you will have, because the more you learn, the more questions you have. I'm disappointed with myself that I haven't filled up one notebook yet. I don't think it's a positive thing, and I go to my teachers once a week, so I should have more to show for it. No, okay. On this point, there's something else. Yes.
Being some time here, I've been confronted with this similar realization that I personally, okay, it's a bit personal, but it's very much what have almost don't have the ability, don't feel comfortable going to rabbis, whether it's you, whether it's, it was Rav Sperling, for other questions, some rabbis in the Israeli program, for certain issues that I felt that in theory I could, since I'm here and I've got access to swan, whether it was in halacha, in this general question, that it should be more up to me to go and find a certain answer. And in this similar situation, that I would end up realizing, what do I ask the rabbis? Like, in these things, when it's a matter of emunah, whether it's of Jewish thought, there's things that need clarification, that need work to work with them. When there are halachic questions, most halachic questions that we're dealing with are not so complex in my everyday life, or a habit. So where's the ability to really use the rabbi?
I think that you'll never regret asking a question. It's only ego. You know, if you can if your question is, what bracha do I make on a cup of water? So yeah, if you'll be learning Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, you'll get to it. But otherwise, I think that a person should always ask. And it says, La Baishan Lamed, you're not going to learn if you're embarrassed. And usually halacha has more details. And even if you'll find a simplistic answer by opening one book, and it's a good idea to open books and to learn. At the same time, if you see, like most people, that you're not getting to look up all the answers to all your questions, and you're living with a lot of questions, so ask. And I can tell you that I have the same ego issue. I also don't like asking questions. And there's also this aspect of, am I going to waste this time asking what bracha I make on a cup of water? So the way I try to get around it is to try and catch a time where I know I'm not wasting his time. To try and accompany him when he's going to the bus stop, or I'll ask the rabbi, tell me when's a good time that I can walk with you, or I can join you when you're doing your shopping or something else, so that I don't feel like I'm taking of his time. And then I'm more at ease asking the question. It's not like I took of his official time to ask a question. I'm walking with him anyways. I know I'm not taking a lot of his time. And if you can't find time like that, well then that's what they're there for. You have to understand, my tradition is, when I got my smicha, so Rav Pesin told me the following story. He said, when Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion was being taken out to be killed, the Romans were torturing him to death. So there's a famous conversation in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, where they were discussing, one rabbi asked the other rabbi, why are we being tortured to death? So he said, I have a hard time understanding why we've come to this. And he said, was there maybe one time that, let me quote you the exact Gemara. Yeah, give me 1 second. Yeah, no. Okay, I'm not finding it. Okay, it's somewhere here. I'm not finding it. Should learn this Gemara once. She said to him, what? they're being tortured to death, and he said to him, could it be that one time a woman came to you with a question and you were sleeping because you ate a little bit too much, so you had to sleep. So that's the level of responsibility that a person has when he's, if he's learned. So his responsibility is that that learning is for the people. And even when he eats, he has to take into account, am I eating in a way that's going to cause me to be a little bit more tired, so I'll be sleeping when people need me for a question. That's our responsibility. It's not something, don't take advantage of it in a stupid way. You know, a person has to be decent. You don't call a rabbi up at 3 o'clock in the morning if it's not something that requires an answer at 3 o'clock in the morning. But at the same time, you don't have to feel bad. That's what a person's here for.
It's more certain on reservation from what I should be expecting of myself. I mean, I have a friend who's studying under Rav Rabinovich in Malaysia. So he told me a few years ago when he first went, what impressed him was that the Rav always expected students, or I don't know if always, but that's what he told me, and it was etching my mind that he was expecting them to do their homework before they came to him with us, with questions. So I'm always feeling that sometimes it's like question is, there's that feeling of being lazy and not researching the subject before you go in front of the rabbi. Like if you are in a certain environment where you're supposed to learn and probe.
Be practical. Are you doing it or not doing it? If you're doing it, good. Obviously you're not. That's why we're discussing this. So go and ask the question. Don't live in doubt. Be practical. Theoretically, yeah, you should. Okay, I also should. We all have areas where we should. But if we're not, so let's be practical and get answers. Mishnah says, istalek min hasafek. Distance yourself from doubt. And doubt is very frustrating. A person leads a very frustrating life. Chazal say one of the blessings that's wished upon a person is that he shouldn't come home and find his wife in questionable state of purity. Because that's worse than her being impure. If he comes home from a journey and they haven't been together in ages and now she's nida, okay, he could live with that. If he comes home and she's pure, he could live with that. If he comes home and it's not clear, that's the worst, Mara says. Because then, every moment, he's telling himself, am I being stupid that I'm being stringent? Maybe everything's okay as it is. So that's considered a troubling situation. So on big questions like whether the couple's permitted to be intimate, that has more weight. But on small questions, it's also a pain in the neck. It causes a lot of frustration in observance. When a person is constantly in doubt and he's not sure, what am I allowed to do, what am I not allowed to do? The person should verify. The Mishnah says, istalek min hasafek, stay away from doubt. We're talking about halacha, but the same thing would go for hashkafa. Same thing. On this point?
On halacha, yes.
Okay.
Not on his specific
point. Fine.
What about like political things? Like certain things, the issues of duo, even like just cautious. You go to anywhere, like there's a bajillion hectoring of everything. And this group doesn't like that group, and this group, so they don't buy from that store because that store has a hectoring from this. And some of it is based on actual halacha, like they make certain leniencies. And a lot, I think a lot of it's not based on that, just based on we don't like them. And we don't like
choose
them.
Your rabbi. Ask your
so
rabbi.
But I'm saying, if I don't know enough stuff overall to pick exact. I may know some areas of how to do shechita. I know what to rely on in shechita. I know what to rely on in checking for tumas and lysos or whatever. But I may not have the time to go. I mean, ideally, I have the time. I go and I buy my own food and I check every single thing. And it's, but assuming I don't have the time, I have to rely on a heksher. And if this, how do you pick a heksher?
Ask your rabbi. When we got married, so the Rav who we were asking was Rav Nebenzal, here in Israel. I can't ask Rabbi Feinstein about what's going on here. So many a time, even a few weeks ago, I called him up. There were new Hashem that hit the marketplace, and I asked him, which of these Hashem could eat, which can't they eat? Whoever your Rav is, they pick a Rav, and whoever your Rav, whoever you rely on.
think the halacha, if you have a political situation, everything's
your rav, that's his business, it's not your business. Hopefully you have a rav that either is in line with where you believe politically or is apolitical, which in my opinion is even better. But that doesn't matter if you have a specific stance politically, so choose a rav within your stance. I have always managed to find teachers who are apolitical. I'm not saying it was easy, but I've always, Baruch Hashem, you know, I've searched, and I'm not saying it was always easy, but I've always tried to learn by people who I felt were above the politics. And if that's what you would like, so then it is doable. On this point,
what does it mean about
politics? I never felt that I got an answer from any one of the teachers who I learned by, be it Rav Halberstam, who was on the Eidah Haredis, who I once went into, and you can't learn from this halachically, because this is a story that happened a long time ago, and I don't know today if he would give me the same answer, but I once went into him and asked him, which hechsherim could I eat from the rabbinate? Which rabbanut on fruits and vegetables could I eat? So he was on Eidah Haredis. The story goes back a long time. So he sat there, and he took his beard, and he said, look, I'm on Eidah Haredis, which means politically, I can't tell you that you can eat from all the rabbinates on fruits and vegetables, even though you can eat from all the rabbinates on fruits and vegetables. Okay? That was his answer. So there are very, very good people out there. You just have to find them. Okay, that was and he was on the Eidah Haredis. You know, that's Me'ah She'arim. You know what the Eidah Haredis is?
I don't know what the Eidah Haredis is.
That's like extreme Me'ah She'arim. They always say don't vote, and it's an avera to vote, and you should have nothing to do with this government, and you know, the last thing they do is give any backing to the rabbinate here to say anything about the rabbanut is good. But Allah is Allah. I asked him a question, he gave me an answer.
We're just as extreme.
Fine, I didn't say we're not extreme. You know, the rule is everyone says they're moderate and everyone around them is extreme.
No, I think
okay, so we're extreme. Just don't put me in that crowd because I still think I'm moderate.
We.
Zane, I'm not with your we, that's all. Okay.
Real quick,
give me 1 second. Bitzal was in the middle.
That's modern, I never got what modern orthodox means. But still, my question is where Chumrot stems from? It's from people that they don't know how to distinguish from Halacha. They get very confused and they say, okay, like toothbrush. It's not my example, it's for other reasons. But could a person understand that he took for himself a certain kind of Chumrot because he doesn't understand, he doesn't get very, very well Halacha on certain points? Or he just wants to be very pious, or he just really wants to draw attention, as you just mentioned.
So again, I don't want to include into chumrot things that people invent. There can be personal inventions that are okay. You know, if a guy knows that anytime he walks next to a Burger King, he ends up finding himself eating a cheeseburger that's not kosher. So then, if he takes on himself the chumrah that he'll never walk on a block where there's a cheeseburger, that's fine, that's his business. You know, part of leading an observant life is knowing where our challenges are. Not only saying, well, the halacha says I can walk on a block where there's a cheeseburger being sold, when he knows he's going to fall for it. You know, so that's fine. You know, but let's leave that, because that's personal. If we speak generally about chumot, so let's take the classical chumot that we usually encounter in halacha, and that is where at some level in halacha, there's more than one opinion, right? So, what would be a good example? Sfaradi or Ashkenazi? Sfaradi. Okay, what? That's a difficult example to discuss because it has that's hidul, that's not chumra. It's a different concept in halacha. Okay, but that's not. Yeah, that's not, I don't think we would call that a chumra. Okay. So, let's say that you you learn halacha, and you see that the Mishnah Brura says you should do A, and the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says you should do B. So if you have a rabbi, I would recommend you ask him. But if a person would want to, he could choose to be more stringent. He could be machmir and say, I want to do something that goes in accordance with both opinions. That's a person's own chumrah. Sometimes in halacha we say a person should be machmir. For example, let's take putting salt in your soup on Shabbos. So generally we say salt, in order to cook it, you have to cook it on a fire. You know, if you have soup that someone poured you from the pot, so that soup is not mevashel. And technically, you could put salt there. But if that soup is scalding hot, there is an opinion that says that it could cook the salt. So we don't rule like that opinion. I just said scalding hot. It is yetzirah klal. So we don't rule like that opinion. And technically, if a person wanted to put salt in, it's permissible. But it's quoted in halacha that being that there is such an opinion, if a person is going to be stringent, then blessings should land on his head. Technically, a person might live in a place where the custom is that they do work on the morning before Pesach. The morning before Pesach, the morning when you're burning your chametz, there are different customs. A person might say, you know what? Being that this custom goes back to the time of the Talmud, that some places have a custom that they don't do at the time of the Mishnah, they don't do work on the eve of Pesach in the morning, so I won't do work. Fine, I'm going to go with that opinion. There you have two minhagim, that's not his minhag, he wants to be machmir. Okay, that can be a place where we'd say, fine, you should be blessed. So chumrot, the classical chumrot that we encounter, are usually, where we call it a chumra, are usually areas where there are multiple opinions in halacha, multiple valid opinions in halacha, and we would say to a person, if you could do what encompasses more opinions, so that's a good thing. Now, a person has to be careful, because he has to know what's the halacha and what's a chumrah. We have to remember that till today we're suffering from the first chumrah in the world. Who was the first machmir in the world? Adam and Eve. Adam told Eve, don't touch it, you're going to drop dead. Along came the snake and touched it. Says the Avos Rabbi Nasan, a fascinating Avos Rabbi Nasan. In Avos Rabbi Nasan it says, what is this similar to? So it says in the end of the first chapter of Avos Rabbi Nasan, it says it is similar to a man who married a Gioret. No more, no less. And he tells her, listen here, honey. If you want to lead the good life, so then don't. Here we go, where's the Medrash? Not finding anything today. It's here. I'm just not finding it. Okay, I'll tell you the Medrash by heart. I'm not finding it inside. He tells her, don't eat without washing your hands. Don't. Where is it? Not finding it. Okay, don't eat without washing your hands. And, here. What's it similar to? L'adam chad shenasa giyor. A man married a giyoret, and he said to her, my dear, don't eat bread when your hands are defiled, meaning without washing your hands. Don't eat fruits without taking off ma'aser. Don't desecrate the Shabbos. Don't make blatant vows, like make nedarim for nothing, and don't go with another man. And if you do any one of these, you're going to die. What did he do? He left the house, and someone wanted to come and cheat with her. So what did he do? He took out some bread and said, watch this. Takes out bread, doesn't wash his hand, takes a bite. Takes fruit, doesn't take off the ma'aser, takes a bite. Goes in front of her on Shabbos and turns on a match. Goes and starts making 100 vows and says, you see, I'm not dying, you're not going to die. Now let's go have a good time. What'd she say? She said, gee, if he lied about everything else, I guess I can do whatever I want. And went and cheated with this other guy. That's what the Medrash says. So who was the first person who was machmir? Adam Rishon. He came along to his wife and said, you be careful, you touch that tree, you'll drop dead. So the snake, he was a smart fellow, he went and he said, look, I could touch a tree, nothing happened. And then he went and pushed Eve onto the tree and said, you see, you touched the tree, nothing happened. Go eat from it and everything will be okay. The snake knew that Adam was commanded not to eat from the fruit. Who said she's commanded not to eat from the fruit? She ate from the fruit, and he told her, now you're going to die. So go give Adam. She goes and gives Adam. Adam's going to die. He wants to marry Eve. Nope. But where did it all start from? The Midrash says, what's saying of Rabbi Nasan? It all started from the fact that Adam was too machmir. So sometimes, when a person tries to be too stringent, what's permitted is permitted, what's prohibited is prohibited. And sometimes we have to know that if we go too far, then it could ruin everything. That's what happened with Adam and Chava, according to some of the Tanaim. So, yes, a pious person is extra careful about keeping mitzvot, and sometimes if there's more than one opinion, the correct thing is to be machmir. But we have to remember that the Stipler wrote a letter, and others have written, the Stipler is the disciple of the Chazon Ish, that one of the great downfalls that people have in their observance is because they try to be stringent where they really don't have to be. So a person has to know that it's not necessarily the greatest thing to be stringent. Now, every so often when I say this in class, I get emails from some of our listeners who say that here in Machon Meir people are looking to be lenient too much and I should stress the importance of being stringent. You have to know that some people have a natural tendency that they like to be stringent, and if they're not stringent, they don't feel like they're being observant. If you're one of those and you're going to feel like you're this, you're not a serious Jew unless you're displeased or unless you're doing things that are difficult because you're stringent, so go for it, fine. It has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with making you feel good about your religion. Okay, fine. Okay, that's also an important thing in life. But for the majority of people who still like being lenient, so then so long as you're within the confines of halacha, and in order to do this, you will usually need a teacher, someone who has learned, and your teacher should not be the guy sitting next to you on the bench in Machon Meir who's here all of a year more than you are. Your teacher should be someone who's been learning for a while. However, but someone who understands you and someone who's been learning. Not the next guy over who's here, even if he's here 5 years, I don't care. At the end of the day, get yourself a Rebbe, get yourself a teacher, and share with him your questions, and then see where you could be lenient and where it would be proper to be stringent. My recommendation, for example, on kashrus, is that any Orthodox hechsher eat. All Orthodox hechsherim are fine, to the best of my knowledge, until we know otherwise. So you have to verify, you know, you have over 1,000 signs of hechsherim. You have to find out which are Orthodox and which aren't. But Orthodox hechsherim, at your stage of the game, eat. You don't have to worry about this stringency or that stringency. You eat. Now, if you're going to invite your cousins who live in Matusdorf or Mesh Arim, and they only eat this Esher and that Esher, so check out with them which Esherim they eat before you offer them their kids' candies or before you make the food for them. But at your stage of the game, I wouldn't worry about anything. You know, if it's kosher, it's kosher. You don't have to worry about all the other Esherim, and the same thing goes for restaurants, and just make sure that the certification is real. Don't go for photocopies. Photocopies are not valid. The true certification, if it's Orthodox, eat there and enjoy.
It has to be date valid as well.
If it's not date valid, then you could call the organization, because sometimes the rabbinate is behind in giving current certificates. So if it's just behind by a week or two, so then make a phone call. Call the rabbinate.
That might take a week.
I found that I could catch them usually within much less than that. Usually the first phone call. And very often you could also ask who the mashgiach is and get his phone number.
It's not the 7 minutes to decide where you're going to eat on Ben Yehuda.
What can I do?
Yeah.
On this point, who was first between you two? I don't know.
Okay.
We'll get back to you, yeah?
On halakhic decision making, okay, I know it's a lot of subject, but just on a principle that arose from this. A rabbi were discussing the issue of saying halal, may not smout, whether it's rough or not. So he told me that till the mid 1960s, there were rabbis that wanted to believe that we should say halal and the bracha on matzmot. They did not decide so because of reasons of, because they didn't want to create controversy, for reasons of shalom. There was a discussion with Chazon Ish, and those rabbis didn't want to get in confrontation. And then later on, they
decided, I'm oversimplifying, I'm not sure I'm doing justice to it, and then later on, they decided to do it after a certain...
64, right?
After, I think, the Six-Day War. And so we see that there, for many years, they believed in a certain... whether we're judging if it was right or not, and that they believed in something that it was... that how it should be done, but for reasons of not causing controversy, they wouldn't paskin in such a way. And then, well, there's another example that... with the, after it was decided, for example, in Merkaz Rahma, they were saying with the bracha why Rav Goren was alive. And after that, they, well, the reason was they stopped. They stopped doing it, like officially, with the same with the bracha. And I heard also the reason that it was that they were saying the bracha, and I don't know, the last of Shishila, that there was also reasons there of respect and of not creating controversy and of like respecting the authority of Rav Goren, like passing a certain way. So the question is, if that's the case, I hope, okay, if that's the case, is it proper halakhically to make certain halakhic decisions on just on what the climate or the in order not to cause controversies, like basically, I was just feeling that people they're ready to compromise in a certain belief or in certain opinions for the sake of peace between, or for the sake of respect for rabbinic view. Is that proper? Is that,
so I'll answer your point in a roundabout way, without addressing this question specifically, okay? Because in general, you didn't ask a specific question. You asked in general, is the issue of keeping the peace something that should be considered in the halachic process? So
that it compromises a person's opinion.
We can't really go into that because you're... there are too many details in that we can't cover here tonight. But without going into specifics, I'll tell you a story that happened a century ago. Again, I don't want to go into the specifics of this story either, because that'll open up a whole series of questions again on this story. So I'll omit the specifics, even though in previous sessions on Thursday night, I discussed the story with all the specifics because then we had the time. Now it's already 1:15 in the morning, so we shouldn't really open a new can of questions. In the beginning of the century, a little bit less than a century ago, there was a certain custom that some rabbis wanted to enact in the United States. This goes back about 70, 80 years ago. And they asked Rabbi Feinstein, and he said, no. So they said to him, but it's a good custom, and it's a custom of piety, and it's a custom that, it's a nice thing that people should do, it's a positive thing, it's a modest thing, why not? So he said to them, everything you said is right, but you have to realize that this custom will be adopted by some and will not be adopted by others. And then you will hit a situation where there'll be a rift. You'll have a situation where these people are doing it and those people are not. And even though you have good logic behind why it should be done, but that logic does not outweigh the price of peace. And it is far more important that there isn't a rift within the Jewish people than to institute a new custom, a new stringency. And he didn't win. They won. Today, if I would tell you what the issue was, you wouldn't believe me that he was lenient on it, because you'd think it's halacha. If I told you what the issue was, and I did in other classes, then you'd be floored, because today everyone that's considered orthodox does it, and no one realizes that technically, halachically, you don't have to. So it's just a new thing of our century.
Issues.
What? I don't want to say what the issue is, because it's not for tonight. Sorry? You won't figure it out, I don't think. But at any rate, And I can tell you, the issue is so sharp that when I had a case where for certain reasons I had to apply the leniency, some people told me they're not going to partake of what was going on. Close friends of mine, who mamash were my closest friends in this country, said that when I would do whatever it was, whatever function it was, where I would apply this leniency, even though it was halachically necessary, and they said, we know you have a halachic basis, but in our family we don't hold of that leniency. Now it became a leniency, meaning I'm being lenient. They're taking a stringency which really started 80 years ago, something that's really new, but I'm being lenient. And even though it was an event where I wanted them to be present, they said, you'll accept our apologies, we're not coming. And they didn't come. They stuck to their word. No, they did come. They came and they said, we wish you well, and left. That, out of respect, they came. They just showed their face and left. But here you see, he was right. He foresaw where it would head. I'll give you another example of that. Because to you it's a norm. To you it's the norm. Because today the people who are lenient are considered off, even though they're not. Meaning, to you it's the norm. A mechitza is quoted, and it's based on a Talmud in Psachim. A mechitza, it depends where. The issue is where do you need a mechitza? Right. So you're right. The issue was about where do you need a mechitza? Right. That was the issue. And we mentioned it in other classes. We discussed this. The event was my own wedding. My friends, they didn't come. I mean, because there were people who, for them, we provided mixed seating. And okay, fine. They each his own. Let's take another example. Also, 50 years ago, there were people who said we have to make kippot that are nicer and that the people from the kibbutzim will feel more comfortable wearing. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda said, don't. We'll make a rift in the crowd. And they said, no, but it's good. It'll bring people closer. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda told the students, don't. Stick to the black yarmulke, because it's far more important that the Torah observant Jews stay together than to put on this kippot sugot and make a rift in Am Yisrael. And they didn't listen to him again. And he was proven right. He was proven right. Unfortunately, look today where we're holding, where a person is gauged, this yarmulke or that yarmulke. People don't believe that I'm in Mahon Meir with a black kippah. Right? Why? Why does it make any difference? He was right. He said it shouldn't make a difference and we shouldn't do this move. But they didn't listen to him. So yes, the idea of maintaining the peace is very, very, very important, to the extent that even when Korach, after everything he did, the next morning Moshe Rabbeinu sends messengers from his court and says, come to court, let's see if we could work something out. And if not for the fact that their response was, we're not coming up to you, you took us out of this great land of flowing with milk and honey, Egypt. If not for the chutzpahdik response, Moshe Rabbeinu already was going out to them to try and make the peace, even though he was in the right. And from there we derive that a court, even when the court is in the right, seeks any way they can, even with people who are not exactly right, to make the peace. The peace is very, very important to us, and it's definitely a calculation in our halachic decisions. Specifically, we said we won't enter the specifics of that case, we'll stay apolitical.
The issue.
Obviously, that's where what we said. We're not touching the issue.
No,
we said
you are going to compromise.
That's exactly what we said. We're not going to enter the issue. The general question is peace between people an important thing to consider? Yes. To the extent where it is also part of the calculations that a posek has to take into account when he gives halachic ruling. Rav Shlomo Zalman is quoted as having said, I didn't see this inside, he's quoted as having said, that when people decide to take on certain stringencies in their own home, they have to consider that they are harming their children's education. Because when your child at home sees that you're machmir, let's invent the chumrah, right? It doesn't exist, but let's invent something. Let's say in your house, when you wash your hands 7 times on each hand. You invented something, doesn't say anywhere. You're going to wash 7 times on each hand. Okay, your son is going to go to his Rebbe for a Shabbos, and he's going to see, he only washes 3 times on each hand. Oh, I don't know if I could eat here. What's going to happen? You're going to take the whole Torah that you're trying to teach your kid, and you're flushing it down the toilet. Because you're putting in the child's mind that this is Torah. And the kid, when he walks around and sees everyone else, well, what's wrong with them, right? Rav Shlomo Zalman is quoted as having said that when you take on stringencies in your own home, you have to think many, many times whether you're helping your home or hurting your children's perspective of other Torah observant Jews, including his own Rabbein. So you see that this concept of the unity within the Jewish people and the peace within the Jewish people is very much a point that we take into account.
I was having the trouble of the compromise that they were ready for something.
That I don't want to go into. Let's leave that.
But, so you're saying we should see really...
In general, it is a concept in halacha. In this specific point, there's much more to be said which you're not taking into account. Meaning you did oversimplify the question, and that's why I don't want to go into it. Let's leave it. Right? Okay. Give me 1 second, because we are running short on time, and Yehuda did start with the question, and David is on Spilkes back there. Yeah? I don't know. Sorry? I don't know. Yes, Yehuda.
Are you supposed to head towards the stringencies? Is someone who's uber stringent, like there is a range? So you can say, I want to be a person who's trying to border on leniency. So would you then say the person is bordering on the upper range? Is that what we're striving for? Should we always be wanting to be there, or should we always want to be some wherever is best for us? Like, do we take us into account, or always striving to be like, upper?
Let's analyze the question and then see if we see the answer. Okay. We agree that our goal at every point in time is to be a Torah observant Jew and do what God wants of us. Okay. Right? So far I'm using general terms, you can't argue with me, right? and we agree that observing the mitzvot means observing the mitzvot to the best of our ability. And if I'm doing to the best of my ability, then if I spend my life thinking I should be doing differently, then I'm hurting myself for no good reason, right? And that's where your question becomes tricky. Because to say my goal is always to be there, I'm not sure my goal should be to be there. My goal is to be the maximum I can be today. And if today my maximum is on the line of leniency, so if I'm doing my maximum, I should be happy with where I am. But the question is, where will I get to tomorrow? So we have to be very careful with the question of where will I get to tomorrow, not becoming the question of why am I not there today. Meaning that's where I don't want confusion. Sometimes if I were to answer you, yes, your goal is to observe halacha to the umpteenth degree with every stringency, then that could be inferred as meaning, so long as you're not there, you haven't made it yet. And that's wrong. Making it means making it today. Well, where's making it today? To do the best I can today. Well, the best I can today might be, as we said, might sometimes be even not even fulfilling the leniencies yet. Could be the best I can do today is to observe 30% of the Torah, 60% of the Torah. I just walked into Machon Meir. I never heard about Judaism. I don't have to feel bad I'm not doing stringencies. I have to be happy. Today I'm starting to keep Shabbos. Today I'm going to start eating kosher. Good for me. I'm happy about it. Down the road, where will I get to? That's a separate question. And sometimes, looking down the road leads us to be dissatisfied with where we are today. And that's not right. So that's why it's a little tricky to answer your question. I think a person has to first ask himself, where can I be today? Now, if you'll ask me, will I ever reach a point where my maximum will be that I can be more stringent and should I be there? That's a personal question that is really depends on the person. Meaning, would I say that a person who was born into an Orthodox home and led an Orthodox life from the day he was born and keeping Torah as second nature to him, should he be on the line of leniency or should he be stringent on issues? So for him, assuming everything is regular, then I would expect that his desire to observe mitzvot would lead him to want to fulfill mitzvot in the optimal fashion, which would include, in certain cases, to adopt the stringent opinion. He should also be aware that adopting too many stringencies leads to where Eve ended up. Leads to curse. Doesn't lead to blessing. Stringency is also something that has to be dealt with. The Stipler wrote his letter to Yeshiva Bachrim, who grew up in an Orthodox home. And he wrote that stringencies can be the destruction of Torah observance. So it's not only about let's be as stringent as possible. No. It's about let me see what the maximum I can do correctly today is. The maximum I can do today might be to be a little bit more stringent on A or B, and it might be not. And a person is dynamic, and the halacha takes that into account. 2 years ago, it's almost going to be 3 years now. Elul, it's going to be 3 years. So our second son was born. He had breathing issues. We were in the hospital. It's Elul. Elul, you want to be focused on tshuva. And I'm focused on doing diapers. I'm dealing with all the kids at home. I'm running back and forth to the hospital. Not exactly what you're dreaming of for your Elo. Comes Rosh Hashanah. I'm in the hospital. Comes the 10 days of tshuva. Seriously, made tshuva. And I'm dealing with doctors. He was born the day after Rosh Hashanah, but we were in the hospital already before then. I'm dealing with doctors, and I'm dealing with the kids and runny noses and everything else. And comes Yom Kippur. So I'm holding the Erev Yom Kippur. And I call one of my teachers and I said, you know, what am I going to do? What kind of year can I expect? If I, Rosh Hashanah, I couldn't be in shul half a davening. Yom Kippur, I don't expect I'm going to be in, if I could be in shul just for Shmona Esrei, I'm happy. I'm here dealing with my wife, the kid, and what can I expect from God? What kind of year have I done? What kind of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur? And he said to me, what do you mean? You did the maximum you could do in your circumstance. If you did the maximum you could do in your circumstance, you could expect the best possible year. You think God wants me more than you can do? No. So that means that this year you're not praying, and you might not make Musaf, and you might not make Shmona Esrei, and you might not make Chazar Sashatz. Okay. But you didn't put yourself in this situation. Right? If this is the maximum you could do today, so who said that there's this roll book that says attendance, did you make it to Musaf on Yom Kippur? No, okay, bad year, right? No, it doesn't work that way. Each one of us is gauged based upon what we could do at every given point. So this is a point we have to remember. And that's why I can't answer you, should we be striving for every stringency? The answer to that is for sure not. Should I be striving to that my observance should be as best as it can be? Well, as best as it can be for me today. Now that's very hard. And that's where you need a rabbi.
It's hard to define the best that it can be.
Right. That's why you need to work with a teacher. You can't work this alone because the range is something that needs to be defined and you can't yet define it for yourself. In order to do it right, you have to work with a teacher. If you can't work with a teacher, then it's hard, right? It's very hard because you're starting. You haven't yet learned the sources and where you could be lenient and where you could be stringent and what you could do. So I gave you a formula today that you could eat in any Orthodox hechsher as far as you know. If it's okay, an Orthodox hechsher, eat there. Some people might have thought, gee, that's terrible. Now, I thought I have to be stringent with this and stringent with that, and I'm Sephardi, and I'm Ashkenazi, and I'm this and I'm that. But no. For you guys at this stage, that's an easy formula I could give you. I can tell you anything it says in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch you could live by, fine, no problem. But that's not enough. You need more leniencies than that. You need a bigger range of what the halacha allows you to do. At your stage of the game, will there come a day where you don't need it? Maybe, maybe not. Depends on where life will lead you. You can be a perfect Jew and live within the confines of halacha and still be going with leniences within the confines of halacha, and that's just fine. Because God doesn't expect you to match up to a rule book. And it's not my invention. There was a contemporary of Rav Yosef Karo named the Mabit. That's the acronym of his name. I don't remember what his full name was. The Mabit wrote a book called Beis Elokim, and that's one of the first points that he says. He says, every person is gauged individually. When we get to Shemayim, God doesn't say, let's see, did you finish Shas? Okay, so now one notch down, you didn't finish Shas yet. He, Rav Yosef Karo, he finished Shas 400 times, he's already up there. No, maybe not. Maybe Rav Yosef Karo reached 99% of his potential and you reached 100%. So then maybe you're going to be looking down at Rav Yosef Karo. That could be. Your gauge based on your potential. And you didn't decide what your potential will be. Because potential is defined by many things in life. By the different challenges we have, by many things. So you can't just answer, well, should I be striving? Should I be striving? You should be striving to be the maximum you could be at every given day. Now that's hard. You know, there's a businessman that I have a lot of respect for who always says his boss is the toughest boss in the world because he's his own boss. If he'd be working for someone else, he could punch in a card. He starts at 8, he ends at 5, he can have a great life. When you're your own boss, it's much harder.
So what situation, first and foremost, how was the year, by the way?
That's a tough question. I think it was a very blessed year. I ran the year with doctors, but you know, there's a Yiddish saying that says, God, scare me, but don't hit me. So we spent the year being scared, but at the end of the year, Baruch Hashem, you know, he's alive and well. We did spend the year running through different procedures and running to doctors, and in hindsight, I could say it was a blessed year, but it was a scary year, so I don't know. I don't know how to gauge that.
Nothing. So, we see that.
But you know, that also has to be gauged on many fronts. I didn't get a lot of Torah learning that year, so you could say it wasn't such a blessed year. There were many fronts. That's hard to gauge. We try to look at the positive and say thank you for it. So in my book, I look at the positive and I say thank you for the fact that the boy is healthy and Baruch Hashem okay.
So nothing. So we have a situation in which we don't wash our hands when we're going to eat vegetable, the cookie, to like. So that's being mahmir, or that's to drop halacha completely. How can and when can we drop an halacha completely?
I don't understand what
like
it means.
In Kitzur Manaro, at least, it's written if you dip the sauce situation, you dip a vegetable into liquid, you should wash your hands. No one does it. I mean, Rav says that there is no need to do it, even if it's written. So the people of Israel drop that halacha, or we are just being too lenient that we don't do it anymore?
That's a good question, which we'll have to